Welcome back to Stand Up Comedy Secrets for Beginners. I'm Ron Temple, and I'm here again with leading stand-up comedy expert Steve Roy. Steve, I have a question. Do you have any experience with stage fright?
I actually have more experience with stage fright than I would like to have had.
Well, you can only imagine, huh?
And just so that people know what we're talking about when we are talking about stage fright, we're talking about a situation where you're in front of a group of people and you are experiencing extreme fear, extreme doom. And let me tell you what, it's gripping. It's gripping.
Now the audience, our listeners mainly know that we're both retired Navy. We both spent 20 years in the Navy. We both were in pretty fearful situations. So compare, contrast.
Oh, well, you know, I got shot at when I was in the first Gulf War. Our ship got shot at, and it was pretty harrowing. But stage fright lasts longer.
See, I knew you were going to say that. Anybody that's experienced stage fright kind of understands that, I think.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like I say, you've got to know what it is. And man, it's just, you've got this feeling of doom or peril. Your mouth is dry. You may be sweating profusely. You may be shaking, physically shaking, which I got to experience all these things. And I'll tell you what happened with my very first stage fright experience. And believe it or not, it was in the Navy. And here's what happened. I put in for a advanced school called Preventive Medicine School. And it was 6 months long, pretty interesting curriculum. It's basically the Navy's version of the public health service, if you know what I'm talking about. You know, it's the people that do all the food sanitation inspections, the people that do all the communicable disease investigating and reporting, the people that monitor the water, the people that catch mosquitoes and identify those. I mean, it's just all this pest control and all these things all wrapped into one. Well, part of this process of this school is you had to go through a 3-week version of instructor training. And the reason being is in that field, you did a lot of, training. You gave a lot of different classes, a wide variety of classes that you had to do all the time. Well, we came to that part of the curriculum, and the big finale is you give your 10-minute lecture. They show you how to make up a lesson plan, and you give your 10-minute lecture on whatever you wrote about that you wanted to present to the class, and that was your finale. I got the lowest grade you could possibly get and still pass. Okay, now here's what happened. Now keep in mind, I had no experience. I had never had a negative experience. Never been in front of a group of people, so I didn't have anything to fall back on. But as soon as I stood in front of that class, dude, I had the white knuckle grip on the podium. I could just barely get the words out that were on the paper. I mean, it was horrible. I was just so frightened and so gripped with fear. Well, I made it through that and went to my first duty station. And man, I was like, oh my God, here we go. Because you know how the Navy works. Once you get out of school, you're ready to roll.
Yeah.
Okay, there's none of this, you know, well, we'll do a little trial period here, whatever. No, it doesn't work that way. So I report as a brand new preventive medicine technician to my first duty station in Jacksonville, Florida. And one of the first things I'm assigned to do is provide food service sanitation classes. Okay, and that's 6 hours. 6 hours of times and temperatures and, you know, don't spit in the leftovers, you know, all that stuff.
Well, go in there before 6 hours.
Yeah.
Hours. Now, is that because you were a new guy? Is that?
No, that's the mandatory.
The new guy's here, he gets to take over?
No, that's the mandatory training that's required for all food service workers. So I had to do that both for the military and the civilian food service workers. So I get started doing this. And I'm still grappling with the whole stage fright thing. And they already have the lessons done, so I didn't have to produce those. I just had to present them. And I think I was on my third food service lecture, because we did these once or twice a month. There were that many food service workers that we had to accommodate. And let me tell you what, I'm about halfway through this lecture, and there may have been 25 people in the room, and one of the guys that was in the class fell asleep so hard, his head fell off his arm, banged the table, and it startled everybody else, what woke them up. And it was at that moment, for me, in the classroom, that the stage fright thing went away. It was replaced with anger. I was literally livid at myself that I was causing people to lapse into a coma. with my training. What's that?
Is that, I hope I'm not hurting our show right now, because you're killing me.
I'm just telling the truth, man. I mean, it was, and so from that point on, I made the conscious decision to do things differently. I was going to do it my way. I was going to have fun, because I knew I was going to be doing this for years. I still had years left on my first enlistment. And I was like, you know, I just cannot be miserable doing this. And plus, I'm ticked. So I made a point to just have fun. Well, to make a long story short, I went from shaking and having the dry mouth and the whole thing to being one of the most in-demand instructors for what I did. I mean, people would go, who's teaching the class? Oh, we need that guy. You know what I'm saying?
And that didn't take you long. That took you like the next time up?
No. I mean, it started the very next time I did any kind of training. And like I said, it was that led me into my first stand-up comedy experience there at the Enlisted Club I was telling you about. And what's odd about that is I was so clueless. I guess I was too stupid to have stage fright. I didn't know. And so I just got up on stage and sucked and left and went, oh man, I'm just not dealing with this again. But I didn't experience stage fright for those initial 3 minutes, the ones that kept me from even thinking about doing it again for almost a decade.
Yeah, we talked about that in an earlier experience. But now, and we talked about me in earlier experience in stage fright, and I still have it. I get in front of a class almost every day. I'm lecturing multiple hours at a time. But when I try to become this person I'm not and stand in front of a podium and give a speech, this is what I suffer from. This is exactly my problem. I'll end up, I can't even read the words. You know, my eyes water up, I shake. And it is absolutely zero difference than what I'm really doing. Now, you overcame it in the class, stepped on a stage and didn't even feel it, which is amazing to me.
Well, that was on that first performance. Now, we'll move ahead. So, I make the decision to try stand-up comedy again. And let me tell you, man, I had some serious stage fright. I was again experiencing what I had experienced before. I mean, it was the dry mouth, the sweating, the shaking. I mean, you could visibly see the microphone shaking as I was doing my act. It was terrible. And I was like, oh man, I have got to get rid of this. And what's ironic now is I didn't have any of that for the classroom. The classroom was already dialed in. I was already programmed. Okay, this is a class. No worries. But there was this huge barrier with stand-up comedy, and I couldn't get over it. And I'll talk more about the reasons for this. There was a couple of reasons, and I'm also going to talk about how I overcame it for myself.
But the one that seems obvious is that you had a bad experience the first time you tried stand-up comedy.
You're exactly right. I didn't even think about that. That may have contributed to the second attempt having severe stage fright. Well, so I thought, well, I'm going to try to do whatever I can do. I just happened to work at I was teaching at the Naval School of Health Sciences there in San Diego. And on staff, they had a licensed hypnotherapist. And I thought, man, okay, I'm going to check this guy out. And I talked to him, and he would help, he was there in that capacity. Now, he did other things too, but his capacity as he was a doctor, he has a PhD, he was a licensed hypnotherapist, and he would try to help students get over their test anxiety. Now, I know you've experienced this with students.
Right, yeah.
Where they just get, they just get befuddled, for lack of better terms, and they can't seem to focus. It's test anxiety. I don't know what else to call it. And so I went and talked to him, and I said, you know, I really want to get rid of this stage fright thing. Can you help me? And he went, oh, yeah, sure. And so I went through a couple of sessions with him, some hypnotherapy sessions, and he made me a tape, and I tried to listen to it. And
did he also make you act like a chicken?
No. And we're going to talk about that here in just a second. But hypnosis is not what people think it is. But anyway, it didn't do anything for me. It did absolutely nothing for me. Now, after the fact, I had found out that only about 25% of the population is very susceptible to hypnotherapy. 50% are somewhat, in varying degrees, susceptible to hypnotherapy, and then 25% aren't susceptible at all. Well, guess where I was at?
Didn't work for you at all.
Not at all. Not even close. I'm not susceptible to those hypnotic suggestions. Now, a lot of this I learned from stage hypnotists that I opened for, and that
those
I knew.
Those are the ones. Those are the ones.
Here's the thing. Have you ever been to a stage hypnotist show?
I did. That's what I was thinking, because they had them dancing and doing chicken stuff.
Well, but here's the thing. The way every stage hypnotist show starts is there's normally between 12 and 15 people that start out on that stage. Did you ever notice that?
Yeah, a big group.
Okay. And then the very first part of the show, and it's usually made funny, but the very first part of the show is to eliminate people.
Those that aren't susceptible.
That's exactly what that stage hypnotist is doing. Because if you'll think back, there were only somewhere between 3 or 6 people that were left when all was done. That's it. Those were the people who were doing the clucking chicken and, you know, being the gladiator or whatever it is they were doing. Are you with me?
I'm with you. What I was doing is I actually not too long ago was given a CD of a hypnotist that he was playing here in San Diego, and somebody wanted me to go to the show. I didn't get to go. So I watched the tape, and this guy, he ended up with a very large group. But you're right. What he did at the very beginning of the show is he went through the audience and he was looking for susceptible people, and he ended up with like 12 on stage. But he was pulling them from the audience. You could tell that he was doing some kind of test to see if they were susceptible.
See, there you go. That's the other technique that you can do. Now, I've worked with both. The ones that did their elimination in the audience, and that's part of their show, and the person who just picked randomly and then got rid of whoever wasn't susceptible. And out of that out of any particular group, you've got 25% are going to be susceptible, you know, and really, to do a show, a hypnotist show, you only need 2 or 3 people that are, you know, doing the chicken dance or whatever it is that they do. You know, and they don't remember anything. They're completely susceptible. As a matter of fact, there's products online that when they say, you know, you can hypnotize someone right on the street. Well, the part that they don't tell you is, you know, and you see this video and these people are completely bedazzled and handing the hypnotist their wallet and that kind of thing. Well, that person was picked out as being highly susceptible to this. Now, I'll tell you another little secret that I know. I've also known several people that have been to prison. Now, just people that I've met in my life, friends and whatnot, did you know that they do not allow prisoners to have any information on how to do hypnosis?
No, I did not. That is off the chart, huh?
Absolutely, because they don't want to provide any advantage for control of the prisoners, which, again, if you relate your prison population to the general population, which I think is a pretty good match, you're going to find 25% are extremely susceptible, and probably another 25% are noteworthy susceptible. And then, you know, it kind of fades from there. Do you get what I'm saying?
I do.
So
I'm gonna relate a story real quick, just a quick one. I knew Steve very well at this time. In fact, we had served together kind of on ships in same port before this. So I knew Steve while he was teaching at the academy. I at that time was smoking. I was a smoker. And Steve said, you got to try this hypnotherapist. And he, I guess I am susceptible, because he actually, I quit smoking for almost 5 years. And on that trip, you know, I quit 15 years ago completely, but that one I did not smoke for 5 years after going through hypnotherapy, and he gave me a tape, and I actually quit smoking through hypnotherapy the very first time. I quit for a very long period of time, 5 years. And for those that don't know, after at the end of 5 years, the reason I started again was the Navy put me in a situation that made me realize that I'd rather smoke than die. So I started smoking. So,
Yeah. It's funny how that potential of getting shot at just goes, wow, you know, here I got this potential, or, you know, I can.
You know, I ducked and said, give me a cigarette. I mean, it was about that quick, too. Okay. That's but true story, and I wasn't even thinking about the susceptibility version, and I didn't know that you were unsuccessful with the guy at the time. I don't even think you'd used him at that time, and I didn't know you were going to even use him. This is the part that Steve left out. He didn't tell me why he knew these hypnotherapists. He just told me there was one on staff. And so I went over, met him while I was in port. I was actually still on a ship, and I was in port, and I went over and met him. And he said, sure. And he actually took me in, and I actually quit smoking. So I was pretty impressed with the guy myself.
Yeah, again, you know, for folks who are susceptible to hypnosis, which is not a bad thing, but people who are susceptible, that may be an avenue that they can explore. The problem is that when you go approach a hypnotherapist, they have a tendency not to determine whether you're susceptible or not. And the reason I say that is because if they did that, then somewhere from half to three quarters of their money would walk away. if you get what I'm talking about.
There are people that would use it in the wrong way.
Well, I'm just saying that they would say we need more sessions and that kind of stuff. And if you deal with a licensed hypnotherapist, especially one that has a reputation, it's not going to be inexpensive. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah. No, I get it.
You know, so I'm not saying that, it doesn't work. I'm just saying that it may or may not work. And in the process of finding out, it could cost you money. I was lucky because the guy that I went to, who was a PhD and was licensed as a hypnotherapist, well, he was on staff, so he couldn't charge me.
Yeah, as I said, he didn't charge me. I should have checked my wallet on the way out, though. I don't remember anything missing, but of course he would have probably put the little note in my head that said, oh, you didn't have any money.
No, he was a good guy. He was a good guy, man.
It really was. It was quite a learning experience for me, and it did help me. In fact, I think I referred a few of the guys on my boat over to him, too, also for smoking.
Yeah, he would help folks that were not at the same command, which was pretty cool. But what I can tell folks about stage fright is that there's two main components involved. The first component is some sort of subconscious programming. And that means that in your subconscious, it's said in there that if you get up in front of a group of people, it's going to be a harrowing experience. The way I'd like to put it into context is, it's the adult version of the boogeyman. you know, you take a little kid, there's something under the bed. No, there's nothing under the bed, but the boogeyman's under the bed. No, the boogeyman's not there. Now, is that experience real for that child?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's just as real as if there were a bunch of cannibals there with knives and forks ready to roll.
So you're saying basically that we're, again, susceptible to our own thoughts in that respect.
Well, there's a thought that, you know, this is something that's kind of built in. I don't know that it's necessarily built in, because you watch little kids and they'll sit there and perform and dance and sing for their family. I'm not sure where this whole concept of, or this subconscious programming of, oh my God, this is worse than jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. I don't know where that comes from.
Well, don't we get that all the time, though, that public speaking is like, it's a greater fear than death?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you take the top five things, that always is above death. People are deathly afraid of this. And again, I can't tell you why exactly. There's theories about this. I don't really deal much with theories and whatnot, but there's theories about this, that this is some kind of ingrained thing that's been learned from generations of evolution. I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is I didn't have any previous thoughts about getting up in front of a group of people. I'd never gotten up in front of a group of people and got ridiculed or embarrassed or anything like that. But when I got up that very first time in front of that class, oh my goodness, it was the worst experience. And I had had my wisdom teeth pulled out during that school time. And that wasn't as bad as that, doing that one little 10 minutes lesson. And man, and at the time I had lost 15 pounds and I didn't have 15 pounds to lose.
Yeah, you still don't.
Well, no, that's not true. I've got a dog food bag I could use. Yeah, I could lose. So, but there's this subconscious programming, and it kind of works like this, and you've seen this in action before. You talk to a student, and they say, I'm really bad at taking tests, right?
Right.
Well, guess what? They are. If they tell you that they are, they are. It is automatically a self-fulfilling prophecy. Automatically, because that's what their subconscious mind tells them. And if you know anything about the subconscious mind, and by the way, this is not some kind of voodoo, weird stuff or anything like that. Your subconscious mind is the part of you that just stores data and feeds it back to you when you need it. It doesn't make decisions. It doesn't make rational or irrational judgments necessarily. All it does is feed you back what it is that you put into it. For example, and you've met these people. I know you've met these people. You go to a group meeting, or you can go to a party. You can go anywhere where there's people that you don't know. And you've met these people that go, I'm really bad with names.
Right, yeah.
And you know what? They've told people that for years. They've had difficulty remembering this. And so this gets stored in their subconscious mind. You're bad with names. So you're going to meet someone, oh, what's your name? Oh, Bill. Oh, hey, Bill. And then you turn around and walk away. And just as soon as you do that, your subconscious mind goes, we're not good at that. Just forget that.
And off it goes.
And off it goes. And you know, that's the subconscious programming of this. If people are really good at something, like they're good at running, they're good at doing arts and crafts, they're good at anything, you'll find that they will pretty much tell people, you know, I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty good at repairing cars. I'm pretty good at gardening. I'm pretty good at what have you. And they sit there and reinforce this, I'm pretty good at this. And guess what? They tend to be pretty good at what they do, you'll find.
Yeah, I actually, one of the first things I do with the first test I give, I usually give a little bit of a lecture on test anxiety and how to overcome it. And one of the things I always tell them is exactly that. The biggest reason you have test anxiety is because you keep telling yourself you do. You know, you've got to first get past the fact that you've studied, you understand it, you know the material, and now you have to tell yourself that you're good at it. So I kind of see that. I don't think I used it directly from, you know, the books As a Man Thinketh and so on, but there are really some easy steps. By the end of my semester, I can usually have folks that have a hard time taking a test lighten up and take them better. But one of the things I use humor for, and this is something that I learned a long time ago, was I always told one of my funniest stories, something that it was more like what you'd call a street joke, but one of my funniest stories right before my first test. And then I would always follow it up with short stories or short jokes before each test. And I used to tell them that it just to ease your mind, just to get you out of that anxiety mode, is realize that this test isn't going to kill you. It's not going to change your life. It's not going to do all of those things. And then the humor would come in, get everybody laughing, and I would actually get a little better results on exams. Now, those that really had super, super test anxiety, of course, we had different techniques for, but most of the time that would get the average person, they're great, you know, they'd get an extra couple of questions, right, because they weren't locking up. They were a little freer to speak. So I think that's what we're talking about, right? The idea that stage fright is one of those subconscious things we put in our head, that it's, I'm so scared to death that, you know, I'd rather die or I'd rather have my wisdom teeth pulled than stand in front of these people.
Well, in my professional opinion, there's two parts of this. There's the subconscious component, and that's what triggers, that's the trigger. But there's also the performance anxiety part. And if you really dig down and find out about students who have test anxiety, you will find that they have really poor study habits. They have really poor preparation habits. And so what has happened is they've gotten into a cycle. They don't prepare well for a test. They might have poor reading comprehension skills or what have you. Then they'll go take the test. They'll do badly. And then here we go. The cycle just starts over and over and over again. Now, I don't think that that causes stage fright to happen per se, but what it does is reinforces that behavior. It reinforces that subconscious programming to say, you know, if you go in, you take a test and you suck at it, then it's like, okay, we just verified we're really bad at taking tests. You know?
Yeah, you know, and using test anxiety works really well, because I keep hearing myself standing in front of this audience and even to this day still will create this anxiety, but I'm doing the same thing. You know, what you just said is really important, because I over-prepare. I think I'm over-preparing for my speech or what I have to give that I always suck at because it's not me, which we've learned, but my preparation, during my preparation, I'm even in my thoughts going, why am I preparing so hard? I'm going to suck anyway. You know, so
yeah, oh man, yeah, that's womp womp. That's not the way to approach that at all.
You know, so I can almost look and see that I'm sitting here going, oh, you know, I'm going to over prepare because I know if I over prepare, then I'll do really well. I'll over rehearse. I'll do all. But during my rehearsals, during everything, I'm going, yeah, but I still going to suck because it's not, you know, I lock up in that kind of public speaking arena. I think I am honestly, you know, going to make a point to put myself in front of people now with a different attitude, with the attitude that we've talked about earlier is that just be myself. Just forget this. You know, go in there, do a couple of bullets, be ready to speak on whatever the topic is, but speak as if I'm lecturing. And I think you've probably geared my stage fright in the public speaking arena, or at least I'm going to give it a good shot, see what happens.
Well, reflect.
That one really helped. That one really was a big plus right there when I heard you say, preparation, because even my preparation, I can actually hear my head going, yeah, you're going to suck anyway, so
why are you well, here's the thing. Reflect back on what we've talked about so far. Here you've got people that are trying to write their way to being funny on stage using a different communication medium than talking. They don't really know what's funny to them. They're trying to make up something to talk about. They're trying to make up the punchlines that are supposed to get the laughs. They don't know how to rehearse in a way that's going to accentuate what it is that they have to say. I mean, do you get what I'm talking about here? I mean, they could not be any more unprepared to get up on that stage. And so they get up on that stage, they're reading notes, they can't remember their stuff, their mouth is dry, they're about to wet themselves, their knees are shaking, their voice is cracking. Can you see how this can be problematic?
I wish I didn't relate, though. Honest to God, I wish that I could say this wasn't me. But, boy, you explained me. In fact, I've often thought that maybe I should wear a little protective garment sometimes. It's so bad sometimes when I get in front of a public. Yet I speak and speak well daily. You know, I think that's always been my own personal experience and weirdness with stage fright. So, yeah, and you need to stop talking about it because I am absolutely freaking out here because I'm going, oh, my God.
It's a very big deal. As a matter of fact, I had determined early on in my stand-up comedy time that I knew that if I couldn't get rid of stage fright, it was going to keep me from getting the laughs that I wanted. The level of laughter, the frequency of laughter was going to keep me from that because you're stumbling over words. You look like a doofus up there. You're shaking. You know, audiences aren't stupid. They know when the pucker factor's high. And the reality is you're going to get the most response that you're ever going to get when you're as comfortable as you could possibly be up there. I mean, if you take a look at, and we talk about this, go to YouTube videos and look at the popular comedians. Do they look like they're having any kind of stage fright?
No, they're comfortable.
And
comfortable.
I can promise you they're not. They're not. What it is they know what to do. They know how to do it. They know that they're going to get a result. And their demeanor, their whole persona, everything reflects that. I mean, audiences glom on to people who have confidence, that look like they're confident. They know what they're saying. And they do so with energy and enthusiasm. And they're genuine in what they're saying. Audiences glom onto that, man. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, no, that's my daily routine. That's more of what I actually do, is that they, you know, I'm confident in the material I'm delivering, and I enjoy what I'm delivering. They enjoy me enjoying it. So it all works out really well in the classroom. It doesn't work if I'm unprepared, if I am suffering from stage fright, if I am having some of those other wonderful symptoms that you just pointed out. But we do end up learning how to become comfortable in our situation, or we quit doing it.
Well, one of the big things that I've hit upon is this whole notion of thinking that, like, stand-up comedy is something bigger, larger than life, something different than standing around with a group of friends and yucking it up. And it's not. It needs to be exactly that comfortable. Because if it's not that comfortable, then you're going to struggle getting the laughs. I don't care how great your material is. You need to be 100% of you as comfortable as you can be. And I'll tell you, I got rid of stage fright 100%. I haven't had it. And I'll give you some examples of how this has done well for me. Now, this is something that I include in my course, is how I got rid of stage fright. So here's the deal. The hypnotherapy didn't work. I knew I needed to be super comfortable on stage. And I got a hold of a book. Now, I understand this is in 1990. This is the end of 1992. And I got a hold of a book that was published in 1986 called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. And it was based on research by a doctor named Shad Helmstetter. And his whole thing was, is if you've got an issue, that means that issue is programmed into your subconscious. I'm bad with names. I'm bad with math. I'm not good at this. I can't do this. Smoking is hard. Quitting smoking is hard for me. You kind of get where I'm coming from?
Right, yeah.
That's pre-programmed. That's programmed, not pre-programmed, but that's programmed through into your subconscious mind through whatever experience you have, and then what you say to other people. Because like I said before, how many people have you met that said, I'm really bad with names, or I'm really bad at math? Oh my goodness, I can't even count the number of people that I've met that have said those two things and more. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're feeding their subconscious mind into saying, we can't do this, we're not good at this, and ultimately they're not. So his research went like this. You can reprogram your subconscious to get what you want, to get the result you want. And the way it works is this. You make up these statements, these affirmations, I guess you could call them. And you make up these statements based on the guidelines that he provides. And he gives you examples of how he used them for himself. I mean, I think the example that he used for himself, one of them was weight loss. He had lost, oh my goodness, 20 plus pounds in less than 2 months. And what he would do is listen to himself saying, losing weight's easy for me. I don't have cravings for this. Yada, yada, yada. You get where I'm coming from? Right. And he would listen to that while he's shaving in the morning.
So he actually taped himself and then just played it back, his own voice?
Yeah, exactly. He would just listen to it. And his what he had to say was this. It doesn't matter if you believe what you're saying. This is one of the things that appealed to me. It didn't matter if you believe what you're saying. What happens is when you listen to you, which is no different than what happens when you talk to other people, you're listening to you tell other people, I'm bad with names, I'm bad with math, I can't cook. Whatever it is, you're doing the exact same thing. All he said to do is just record these affirmations and listen to them. It doesn't matter if you believe them or not. And if you listen to them long enough, changes will happen. Are you with me?
Oh, I'm with you, because you do know I practice this also. Now, I didn't get it from him, but the same thing. I practice not so much the recording, but I really am conscious of words. And you've heard me say it. Most of my life, it's words have power. And we give words power that we shouldn't. And we often say those things like, and we don't even realize we're saying it. You know, I wish I could lose some weight. You know, I'm
wish,
I'm heavy.
Can't, yeah. Won't.
Yeah, won't. And you throw all those negatives. Well, really, the subconscious is saying, yeah, well, it is hard. Or I say that. I've said that. Man, one of the hardest things I've ever done is lose weight. You know, lose a pound, man, it's hard. And didn't even win. And as you use that as an example, I realized even in my own life, even though I practice what you're saying, is there's a whole lot of things I've gotten done in life and gotten over some of the things, some of my issues that I should be dealing with, like stage fright and weight, then, yeah, and you know, this is therapy now, Stevie. I don't know if you're getting paid for this, but we're into my head now.
Well, I'm just saying it's a pretty simple concept. There's no voodoo or magic to it. So what I did was this. I constructed 15 statements specific to me, what issues I was having, and they weren't all about stage fright either. But I crafted 15 of these and recorded them using a cassette recorder. And then what I did was I got a 90-minute tape, and I just recorded over and over on this 90-minute tape this 15 things that I had said, these positive affirmations, I suppose you could call them, constructed from the book. And so I had a 90-minute tape, two 45-minute sides. Well, at the time, I was driving a 1972 white Volkswagen Bug. Do you remember that car?
Oh, I remember the airbag.
yeah, the airbag that wasn't there?
Yeah, the one that I was driving with Steve one day, and he decided that airbags were necessary for his Volkswagen, so he brought in some balloons. So this is what I've dealt with all of my life with this guy.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. That balloon thing was good. Here you go.
There you go.
Yeah, the look on your face was priceless. But
because yeah. I still, and I you've heard on this session for sure, is every once in a while he hits a tickled spot on me, and I can't help it. I don't know why.
Well, here's the thing. That car, when I bought it, didn't have a radio. And when I sold it, it didn't have a radio. So what I had was one of those portable cassette tape players. You remember those things? I mean, it was about the size of a shoebox, you know, flatter, of course, but it was about the size of a shoebox. Well, I set it in the passenger seat, and each morning when I drove to work, I played it all the way. That's all I listened to, was me telling me how I was based on what I did, based on these statements that I...
They end with, and they like me?
No, well, I mean, you know, I had stuff like, you know, performing stand-up comedy is easy and comfortable for me. Stuff like that.
Okay.
Okay, and I've got the exact statements that I used over and over again. So I turned it on when I went to work. I turned it on when I came back. When it got to the end of the 45 minutes on one side, I could just switch it over and just start right all over again.
Well, we know they work because there's a congressman right now that used it quite often on Saturday Night Live. And now everybody likes him, okay? Sort of.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, I did that for 30 days and it went away. I mean, went away forever.
Does it come back at all, though? Not the stage fright, but the affirmations, the voice in your head. Does that come back?
No. I mean, after listening to this for, oh God, less than a week, I didn't even hear what I was saying. It was just background noise.
But it did work. I looked back at the hypnotherapist. I told you he sent me home with a cassette tape, and I was supposed to listen to it, and it kept, and that's what it was affirmations. It was a relaxation tape, and then but he made me record my voice on it.
Yeah, that's what happened to me, too. Yeah. He did that, so it was like, woo, yes, I need this, woo, you know. I don't know. And there was supposed to be maybe some subliminal stuff in there. I don't know.
Well, my voice was subliminal. That's what the idea was. In the back.
Mine wasn't. It stuck out like a sore thumb. It just went, yes, I need to do this. And I was like, well, man, that sounds awful.
So it's kind of, so you are reprogramming the subconscious just from the repetition nature of it. So it's really not susceptibility to hypnotherapy. Where I was somewhat susceptible, and I assume somewhat susceptible because it took a couple of sessions to get me to that point. But I do remember that tape, and yeah, you're right. It was relax, 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 with the beat, relax, relax, and then it would go. And you're not a smoker. And that was me. I'm not smoking. You know, cigarettes are bad. You know, whatever it said. But these messages would pop up, and it kind of throw you out of the relaxation mode. Yeah, kind of like the beach. But it did stop me. You know, 5 years, I didn't pick up a cigarette. So,
well, I'll tell you what, I haven't had stage fright since I did that. Now, I will say this. I listened to that. I just got into the habit of listening to that, and I ended up listening to that in that car until I got rid of that car. because there wasn't any radio. I mean, what difference did it make?
And well, they, you know, Steve, I don't know if you know this, but they actually record music on those cassette tapes, and you could have just stuck them.
No. This was more important. I mean, so I just kept playing the thing, but after 30 days, I'm just telling you, it was done. It was done, and I, you know, I wasn't taking any chances. It worked so well, so I just
kept. Let's go back. Since you did the therapy on that, the other ones, I'm bad with names, I'm bad with math. You can use the same. Basically, that's what he was saying. Do the same thing. If there's something in your life that you're having difficulty with, you basically just want to take the old date out and put the new date.
Well, yeah. Instead of saying I'm bad with names, you say I'm really good. I'm really good with names. I can easily remember names. I remember names forever. Those types of things. Now, I will tell you something that I used to do, and this used to just amaze my traffic school classes. I'd have 40 people in a class, and the first hour and a half was having everyone introduce themselves and say what their violation was. And a lot of them was speeding, but some were rolling through a stoplight. There was one guy, he got a violation because he was driving through the fog, and the way he was doing it is he had the door open and was watching the white line go by.
He lives where I live.
Right? Well, yeah, I mean, this guy was a total idiot, you know, but I would go through, and so I'd go through this process, and then as soon as I got to the last person, I'd say, okay, let me see if I remember everybody's name, and I'd go through and name every single person in that room, and they were shocked. I would get applause from this group of people, and I would say, would you like to know how I did that? And they would always go, oh man, tell them how you did that. I said, well, I know something as an educator, and as an educator, I know that it takes 7 exposures of any certain thing before you can retain 90% or more of that information. So you'll notice when I went around the room, I went, okay, what's your name? Bob. And I'd say their name again. Bob. Okay, Bob, what was your violation? And then they'd tell me the violation. I'd say, well, Bob, what did the police officer say? Well, he said this, blah, blah, blah. And then I'd make a comment about that. And then I'd say, well, let me just tell you, Bob, I really appreciate you being in the class, and you're really going to get a lot out of this, I can tell, blah, 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 whatever. But did you notice I repeated the name over and over and over again? Well, while they were talking to me, I would also say in my head, Bob, 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 Bob. This guy's Bob. Bob with the sweater. Bob with the glasses. Bob who was tall. Bob who was fat. Whatever the deal was. And I'd say this in my head. And so by the time it went around the class, I mean, I had everyone, I had said their name multiple times. So I had it in my memory. But I said, you want to know the real secret? The real secret is this. I don't say I'm really bad with names. I never say I'm really bad with names. I always say I'm really good with names. I can remember names easily. Remembering people's names is easy for me. Do you get what I mean?
So
I'm not undercutting myself. Because if I tried this technique, but all I said was I'm really bad with names, do you think it would work? Absolutely not.
No. Yeah, no. That's a words have power routine that I do. It truly, really, we do reinforce the problems we have in our life. And I think you know this as an educator. You've seen people really respond well to certain material you give them because you don't allow them to think much more than this is the best thing that's ever happened to them. And if they can keep that up, that class becomes easy. And I did teach math. I taught algebra for many years, and the first words out of most people's mouth coming into that class was, "I hate math. I don't like math.
Math is hard. It's always been hard for me.
Always been. It's ridiculous. I can't believe it." So that was big part of my first parts of my lecture is, you know, you learn to love the things you hate, but you're going to love this. It's easy. We can do this. There's not a problem. And I often would get at least four or five people in a class of 30 or so that would end up walking out of there going, you know, this is the best experience in math I've ever had. Now, it wasn't anything I did other than tell them that they're going to have a great experience. So I put it up ahead, right in the front, and then math became easier for them. And realize that's easier for me. That was the other side. You know, this is easier for me because if they're not getting math, I'm spending a lot more time with one or two individuals than I am with a whole class that gets it and then can even help the other individuals. So,
I'll tell you how powerful this was for me. I was performing all the time, regularly, didn't have any kind of stage fright issues whatsoever. Didn't matter where I was at, big gig, small gig, I didn't care. It was just gone. Well, when I moved to Hawaii and my wife and I purchased a restaurant right on the beach, I set up my one-man show there, and it was awesome. I just loved it, and I think I mentioned this before. If we had gotten a liquor license, I may still be there. But that was the only thing that was making money was my show. But let me, what the part that people don't know is I hadn't been on stage for 18 months before that first show. And dude, I hit that stage just like I had never been off it. But I will also tell you this. I rehearsed, I started 30 minutes a day. This was 3 months out. And that 30 minutes a day went to an hour a day. And that was what I was doing, was an hour. And I did 15 brand new minutes of comedy material that was specific to Hawaii when I performed. So, but what I'm saying is after a break of 18 months, you'd think that I might have some anticipation. I mean, some of the stage fright issues, would you say?
Yeah.
No, I didn't have a lick. Not a bit. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't get excited, that you don't have anticipation. That's different than stage fright. You know, the anticipation I'm talking about is kind of like if you like roller coasters and you're standing in line and then it becomes your turn, you get that anticipation. Okay, this is gonna rock. And then you go through it and you go, oh man, that was great. Okay, that's different than stage fright. Stage fright is crippling. I mean, it'll just hold you back.
Yeah, I know. Well, I wish I didn't, but I know. Yeah.
I remember those first open mics the second time that I started my stand-up comedy career. And man, I had to go pee 4 and 5 times. Couldn't drink anything, not even water, beforehand. Then I'd get up on stage and my knees were knocking and my mouth was so dry, I was making that smacking sound, you know, when I talked. It was just, oh, it was just so horrible. I can remember it like it was yesterday.
And you really give all of the credit really to you telling yourself you're no longer susceptible to stage fright, basically.
Yeah, and like I said, my affirmations didn't just include stage fright. It included ease of producing comedy material, ease of everything. I mean, that just got ingrained in my brain. And so things were pretty darn easy for me. So it's a big deal. I know people experience this. You can get over it. You can get over it. But you're not going to get over it if you say, I can't get over it.
Well, we went through a really, I mean, I think this method works for so many things that we have problems with in life. But do you know of any other methods to get rid of stage fright?
Well, there's, if you take a look at NLP stuff, do you know what NLP is?
No.
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Okay, I do now.
Okay, it's this technique that was developed in the 70s by a couple of psychologists to try to do exactly what we've been talking about, change behaviors, influence behaviors, and those kinds of things. Now, if you go look at stuff online, you will see that people either just rave about it or they go, it's bogus. And interestingly enough, there's been no scientific confirmation that works. You know? So I don't know if it's a placebo thing or how that works. I mean, there is such a thing as a placebo effect, and
but isn't that kind of what we're talking about? Really?
No, it's not the same. It's a means of what you say, but also involves like touching your finger to your thumb and having that kind of connection that's associated with what you say. I mean, I just am not versed enough to say yay or nay. It's not what I used, so I'm just telling you what people can find online.
But that does, like you said, it works for some, doesn't work for others.
Well, you know, you could say the same thing about hypnosis.
That's what I say. It comes in the same place.
Does that make hypnosis bad? No, it doesn't.
Right.
I'm just telling you that as a comedian, it behooves any comedian to invest in the most important part of their stand-up comedy career, and that's them. So if it takes hypnotherapy to get over stage fright, whatever. Go for it. If you can use the affirmations that I provide, and I provide the book, and you know, they can get their own book and make their own affirmations, fine. If they're able to use NLP, well, that's fine too. It's just so important to get over that stage fright thing, because I'm going to tell you, man, when you're comfortable on stage, the world is your oyster. You have the most control you're ever going to have over an audience. End of story.
And we've mentioned that that's a really addicting.
Oh, let me tell you, the rush of causing people to laugh, I mean, laugh long and loud and frequently, there's few things that compare with that. As a matter of fact, some folks get into issues with drugs because they can't sleep after a show. I mean, it's just that intense. The adrenaline's flowing. The audience doesn't see your adrenaline flowing, but you walk off that stage. I'll just tell you, the first time I performed for 1,500 people, and I could feel the air pressure differential from the laughter on my chest, I couldn't sleep for 3 days, dude.
I understand that, because I teach classes at night. I'll teach an evening class, and when I'm in the zone, or I'm on the roll, or whatever we call it today, it's hard to sleep. It's hard to
go down. Well, because you're just basking in that whole experience. You're running it through your head, and you're like, yes, yes, I'm a hero, you know, or whatever it is. Whatever it is that people are saying, you know, that whatever you're saying to yourself.
We are the champions. Yeah, I know. It's just exactly what happens. We've run out of time, but there's more to come, so don't miss the next episode when we reveal more stand-up comedy secrets for beginners.